Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Celia Farber, and I'm here with my co-host, Christina Borgeson. Our guest today is a legend and a human buffer against the typhoon of lies, psychological operations, mental terrorism, and the deep state media fire hosing us 24/7. Whether we own a TV or not, he's an author and frequent guest on many international alternative media broadcasts, has been a freelance journalist for over 30 years. His hugely popular newsletter, No More Fake News, has been front and center in the information wars since 2001, a good 15 years before the term fake news was ever even popularized. He is, of course, the one and only John Rappaport. Now, before we bring John on, I want to describe one of the things that makes his work so unique. I've been giving it some thought. It's his depth and scope, his research into what we all know of as the Matrix. But if I were asked to define the Matrix, I would really struggle with it. We know what it is. We know how it feels. We know we're living in it. But John took it much further than that. He started doing in-depth interviews with insiders at every level of, I would say, operational society, the place where the levers are pulled. And he got all these really interesting people to go on the record and tell us how it works inside, how it works inside the Matrix, provided their identities were kept secret. And these insiders, they had deep knowledge of, I'll just name a few of the fields: propaganda, finance, hypnotism, mind control, medicine, intelligence operations, and more. One of his sources described it like this: imagine a factory that turns out illusions. And these illusions are woven together to make up what we think the world is. John came across his insider sources while writing his first book, which was called AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century, in 1987, which was just when the staggering lies about AIDS began to crackle apart, or at least got their first death blow. In the form of Peter Duisberg's broadside in a journal called Cancer Research. John Rappaport and that book, AIDS, Inc., played a major role in breaking that spell, the AIDS spell, and I remember it vividly at the time, how relieved I was that John was around, that that book was around. Now, little did we know that after AIDS propaganda would at long last begin to fade, that they would have countless more fake epidemics up their globalist sleeves. And you probably have guessed which one we're going to talk about today. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom the one and only John Rappaport. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much, Celia. Great to be here and finally talk with you after a long time.
I know, it's been a really long time, but I follow your work. And, you know, your No More Fake News is the newsletter, the news bulletin that most people from all walks of my life send me. Did you read this? Did you see this? It's really popular. It's really great stuff. And it covers, like I said, just so many areas where most people, you know, they get this part of it or that part of it, but they don't get the other part of it. And I feel like you get all of it, the everything bagel. So, John, tons to talk about. I just like conversation, you know, questions more maybe in the courtroom. But I just want to talk to you about, I know we have to talk, we have to deal with the corona madness. But let me just ask you this. Do you feel that there's anything different about I wasn't going to start with Corona, but I am anyway. I changed my mind because I'm amazed, you know, after all the fake epidemics, this one has really gotten into people's heads. And what's fascinating about it is we can use everything we learned in the AIDS debacle to help people kind of diffuse their fears about this one. Do you agree with that?
I do, indeed. Actually, I see a repeating pattern in all of these fake epidemics. The strategies are always the same. And the degree of fear and certainty on the part of many people that this is the big one, doesn't matter what happened before. Yes, we said it was going to kill 100 million people, and it didn't. Maybe it killed 800 people. We're not even sure of that, out of 7 billion. But it doesn't matter, because this time it's the big one.
Right.
And then it's
right.
not.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, you've been there, so you understand completely. And each time it's that way. And I will say that this time, partly because social media has exploded and the web is much more extensive than it ever has been, online and so on, that the fear and the amount of opinion that is circulating that is fearful and yet at the same time absolutely certain that this epidemic is quite real and that it's going to destroy untold millions of lives is greater in quantity than in any of the others, for sure.
Well, it's a cold virus. Do we agree so far? Corona, well, okay, what's a virus? This could get really esoteric, but
yeah, it could.
Yeah. But Corona has been around, and nobody, like so many of these, it all starts with something that has been lying around, which is, of course, what Peter Duisberg said about so-called HIV. And you and I both know that so-called HIV probably doesn't exist at all as a natural pathogen, but only as a laboratory artifact, to which most people go, what? So that's a big rabbit hole. But as for coronavirus, the reason people are emailing me and no doubt contacting you about it is because what's gone around is that there are 4 HIV inserts in the coronavirus. So now, oddly enough, it's become, you know, argue with me if you don't agree, it's become weirdly mainstream to talk about a bioengineered pathogen, which used to be crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting all sorts of emails about it, and people are talking about it, and discussion groups are kicking it around, and they're all quite sure that, yes, this is an engineered virus out of a lab, and that it is a bioweapon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things that I've been writing about even today is, and this would be, you know, hard for many people to accept, these people are basically working off of published so-called genetic sequences of a virus. Lots of symbols and figures and long rows, etc., etc. This is what it is. This is what it is. This is what it is. And then somebody looks at this sequence and says, well, here's a curious spot in the sequence where there's a break where there shouldn't be a break. And this indicates to me that somebody tinkered with this virus in a lab, you know, something along this order. And what I'm saying is basically, I don't automatically accept these published artifacts of genetic sequences and codes and numbers and symbols and so forth as, you know, God's absolute truth to begin with. Mm-hmm. Therefore, inferences that people make from that are very suspect, and they should look quite a bit deeper. And I'll give you an example. In 2009, the so-called swine flu epidemic that was threatening again to kill millions, and the CDC was saying that there were thousands of cases in the U.S., Cheryl Atkinson, who was an investigative reporter for CBS at the time, discovered that the CDC had secretly stopped counting cases of swine flu in America. And, of course, their mandate is to count the cases and report them. So what was going on here? On the one hand, they were saying it's expanding, there are thousands of cases, and yet they've stopped counting. She found the reason, and it was because the overwhelming samples, tissue samples from patients, swine flu patients, that were routinely sent out to labs, many, 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 as part of the ongoing kind of surveillance, were coming back from those labs with absolutely no sign of swine flu or any other kind of flu whatsoever. In other words, the virus wasn't there. There was no sign of the virus whatsoever. It was as if it had never been found, isolated, and discovered in the first place. And yet they were going on, the CDC, to say, which I discovered 3 weeks after CBS shut down Cheryl's investigation, the CDC then claimed there were 22 million cases of swine flu in the U.S.
Wow.
So there's just one of several instances where all of a sudden there's no sign of the virus whatsoever, which could very well suggest that the whole process of discovery was so seriously flawed and perhaps even artificially rigged to create something out of nothing that was not even there in the first place.
I want to introduce, you know, if we were all together, I would be guilty of terrible rudeness. I haven't introduced you and Christina. I don't know if you're familiar with Christina's work, which is really extraordinary. Her big story, just like for me, the big story was AIDS. For Christina, her big story and her, you could say her rebirth, perhaps in some ways, undoing, but I wouldn't call it an undoing, was TWA Flight 800. She was at CBS and a high-flying Emmy Award-winning producer and was put on the TWA Flight 800 story and very quickly got to the truth about it, namely that it didn't just blow up because it was overheated, but rather was hit by missiles. So she's our sister. She knows all about how this goes and the official story and the government and then how you get pariahed for asking all the right questions.
So, hi, Christina.
Hey, John. Hey, I was, I was reading an article that you wrote that Celia sent me, and I was so struck by the fact that you said you had written that the coronavirus has been around for a very long time, and, there's nothing more deadly about it than anything else, really, right? Is that I think 1945 or something you said it
was? That was the Zika virus.
Oh, Zika. Oh, okay.
1947, and it had never really caused any harm whatsoever, but supposedly all of a sudden it was causing babies to be born with smaller heads and brain damage.
It turns out that what's it called, when the heads are smaller?
Microcephaly
is not right. Caused by Zika. Is that what you reported?
Yes, and what I said at the time and later was, it turns out that any insult or injury to a pregnant mother can cause microcephaly.
Exactly.
So it doesn't have to have anything to do with the virus.
So the coronavirus. I was mistaken that the coronavirus...
Well, what I was saying about this Chinese coronavirus was that the official story was and is that the researchers have absolutely decided that this virus jumped from animals to humans...
With no proof.
Between, in the month of November.
It's a tight window.
Yeah, very tight window, yeah.
Very tight window, which is completely absurd. I mean, they have no way of saying that, but they do, because they have to. Because if they admit, you know, it's been around probably for a long time, and who knows, it could have been around for 200,000 years. I mean, we don't have the tools to know that, in which case, if that's true, why are we suddenly saying that it's causing people to die now? So they have to concoct a story about how they absolutely know that it jumped species into humans in the month of November 2019, which is just laughable.
But what's extraordinary is that they come up with these scary fairy tales, and people, even our kind of people who are seer-throughers in alternative media, it's code, right? So, and it hits some kind of receptor sites, no pun intended, in people. Not you and I, we've been in it for too long, but people still react like, oh, you know, and I'm so fed up with this fear-mongering.
Well,
I cannot tell you.
This is what people are seeing. People are seeing reports about the Chinese building a hospital, I don't know, several thousand beds in 2 weeks, but to deal with this coronavirus. They're seeing a video of people keeling over in the streets. They're hearing that people are being quarantined. And then somebody's coming out and saying, oh, yes. I read some report where somebody was coming out and saying, oh, yes, what seems to work for the coronavirus is an antibiotic along with some sort of anti-HIV drug. I mean, these are the things that are being reported out there in, you know, prominently. So that's why people are fearful, and obviously they don't know what you and John know, that this is deja vu all over again, and that the science is not there for this. But what is happening? I mean, are people coming down with this, with something, or what, you know?
Yeah, so let's talk about what we know for sure. John, I want you to go first, and then I really want to hit that head on, what Christina said, because I got some new information through our friend David Crow this morning, an excellent paper that he wrote on real truths about the situation. But if you would just give us your, what we know, what you know for sure, truth from media hype.
Okay. Well, Wuhan is supposed to be the center of the so-called epidemic, a city of 11 million people, an economic powerhouse with a gross national product of about $220 billion a year. Many foreign countries have invested in corporations there. There are about 80, I believe, Fortune 500 companies operating there. And there is a unique form of air pollution in the city.
Bingo.
And in other Chinese cities. A study that I, which I thought was quite intelligent out of Yale, which I've quoted in a recent article, said, this is an unprecedented, never-before-seen mixture of toxic elements in the air in a city, because in Chinese cities you have the collision of two separate eras or ages of modern development. You have what you could call early industrial revolution pollution and then modern industrial pollution elements, sulfur and so forth and so on, listed about five or six of these, that are all mixing together. And the previous studies that have been done on this kind of pollution only look at one at a time. They don't look at the synergistic effect of all of these operating at once on the lungs of people who live there. We do know from articles that last summer in Wuhan, there was a major protest on the streets, which is not usual for China. We're talking about lots of people protesting the foul air pollution and the lung problems that they were suffering in the city, which was shut down by the government. Other protests in other Chinese cities along the same lines, cities which all are now locked down and quarantined, supposedly, because of this, quote, coronavirus, of which the main emphasized symptom, aside from ordinary flu symptoms, is pneumonia, lung damage. So that's called a clue, a major clue, and it's being completely ignored by the press all over the world and by the Chinese. And so this is just one example of what actually is going on in these cities. The virus has always been used as a cover story for destruction, damage caused by governments, corporations in the third world, the second world, the first world, wherever it is. I've detailed this in many, many articles and in my book, AIDS, Inc., as to how it's used. And it relies, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I'll just try to boil it down. There is a psychological obsession in people, subconscious, to pin damage and destruction on the one thing, the thing, the one, the evil one, the
right.
evil thing, the it. If you come at them and you say, let me describe what's happening in Africa or in Haiti. I got a real lesson on Haiti from a public health expert when I was doing early research on HIV, and she said, practically screaming in the phone at me, you have no idea what's going on down here as to what's killing people and what's been killing people. You've got contaminated water. You've got sewage.
Exactly. I'm from Haiti. I know.
Christina grew up there.
Yep.
Okay, so...
Yep.
You're talking multiple destructive causes.
Exactly.
All operating at the same time. Well, people don't want to hear that. What they want to hear is, show me the one thing, the one evil.
So true.
And so when you say, okay, it's the virus, and it's called the COVID-19, whatever it is, okay, that's it. That's it. And they take off from there.
Yeah. I'm laughing because I really loved your description of, what did you say, symbols and signs and numbers, and it's such a good way to describe the, you know, the mumbo jumbo that people get caught up in, and instead of the looking around. And as you say, in China, I worked for a family once where they had visited China, and they no more than got off the plane, and the wife fell devastatingly ill, and many years later had not recovered, and they hired me to try to find an apartment that she could live in. She had developed multiple, she couldn't breathe, she had electric sensitivities, couldn't be in a room with any it was terrible, you know, and this was definitely from just turning up in China and breathing the air.
So what were you going to say about, you know, the reports and the video of people keeling over?
Right.
And
okay. Now, I interviewed David Raznick, Dr. David Raznick yesterday. I'm sure you know him. I've known him for a long time. And this morning, there's a lot I could say about what he said, but let me just give you the headlines. He said all viruses are essentially wimps compared to us. Except in the very young and the very old, by and large, there's not going... And I said, well, tell me about the scariest deadly viruses we know of, like Ebola. And he said, well, there's a lot of bogusness even around Ebola. I left the... it's going to be published soon, this interview, possibly today, at uncoverdc.com. But that wasn't even the point I really wanted to get to, which was this. He said, have you read David Crowe's paper? So David Crowe actually has a show here on PRN called The Infectious Myth. And I've known David Crowe a very long time, but I hadn't read this paper, and I have it in front of me. It's called SARS. I'm going to send it to both of you after the show. SARS-2, the 2019 coronavirus scare. Let me just clear off my glasses here. So one of the things we're meant to believe about corona, and And, you know, we all know about trauma-based mind control, like we see the planes flying into the towers over. So the equivalent of that in this story is that man keeling over. And we are meant to infer that that man keeled over from sudden death or near death from corona, right? We all
right.
agree
and
so
there are
far.
People lying, other people lying in the streets and stuff.
Right.
Too.
So yeah. that would mean this is a, you know, somebody breathes on you and you're dead
right.
kind of situation. So I'm going to read from David Crowe's paper an actual little epidemiological crystal drawn from real life. Now, does anybody here remember that there was a situation in Germany with a Chinese? Did you read about this, John?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So here's what it was. Sorry, give me one second to find it here. Why is it that as soon as you're looking for something in a text, you can't find
it? So all these moves to...
Yeah, talk a little bit and I'll find it, because this is important.
You know, I think the thing that terrifies me about this whole thing is what might come next, which would be mandatory shots or vaccines to deal with this.
We have to talk about that. I can
let's
a couple things about that.
Let's hear what you have to say.
Well, I'll defer to Celia.
Yeah, I found it. Sorry, you guys. Okay. So regarding transmission and the concept of sudden death and the man keeling over, etc., in his paper, David Crowe calls this transmission the German connection. Reference 9 attempts to connect the illness of a German with a meeting with a Chinese woman who afterwards was diagnosed positive on the RNA test. Corona RNA tests. We can't get into everything that's wrong with the test, but everything is wrong with the so-called corona test, just like everything is wrong with most diagnostic tests out there, which don't generally test for pathogens. But that's going to have to be another show. Okay, so the sequence of events started on January 20th, I'm reading from David Crowe's paper, to January 22nd, when a woman from Shanghai and a local German were in meetings together. Both were healthy at the time. The woman flew back to China on January 22nd and started to feel sick on the flight home. The German got sick, sore throat, chills, muscle pain, fever, cough, late on the 24th, and did not return to work until the 27th. By coincidence, on the 27th, the Shanghai woman informed the German company that she had been sick and had tested positive for RNA. That's David Crowe being accurate. A typical media outlet would say tested positive for corona. Okay, by this time, let's say tested positive on the test presently being used as a coronavirus test. Okay, by this time, the German man had recovered without any special medicines or interventions, but he tested positive. So did three other colleagues who had contact with him or the Shanghai woman or both. It is logical that everyone who had any contact with them was tested, and likely no employees who did not have contact were tested. The paper does not say how many tested negative and how many of any of those had symptoms. The article shows that all four Germans had symptoms starting on the 24th, 26th, or 27th, but what those symptoms are is not detailed for the other three. Indeed, the article notes that, quote, none of the four confirmed patients showed signs of severe clinical illness. If the purpose of the paper is to support the idea that this illness is transmissible, it's important to accept the four positive tests on Germans as true positives, despite the fact that none of them had, quote, severe clinical illness. However, this calls into question the severity of the illness and why heroic and dangerous medical measures are needed. Because the Germans did not find out about their positive RNA test until after their illness, they only had to suffer quarantine. They did not have to suffer antiviral drugs, steroids, or invasive respiratory assistance, which might have happened if they'd shown up in an emergency department with symptoms and had been diagnosed with the 2019 coronavirus at that time. An alternative explanation is that the coronavirus is deadly, but that these four Germans represent four false positive tests. If this is the case, the usefulness of the test must be questioned. Okay, so that was long, but I hope you understand why I walked us through that. So we have here people testing positive for the thing we're told is super scary. They're getting ordinary colds. They're not even noticing it until the media-led scare goes out. The woman responsibly says, I'm from China and these people had contact with me. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is it's another dud. It's nothing.
Right.
Just one more thing. As for the man keeling over, in his paper, I'm not going to take time to try to find the exact sentence, but I remember it. I said, David, what about the people keeling over? And he said, the one that we've been seeing on TV he said maybe not that one, but at least one of the people who are being described as keeling over was actually in the process of attempting to break out of quarantine. And was somehow struck or felled by something. So you don't fall down on your face on the street from any coronavirus infection.
Right. So if you gave me a small film crew and a good cutter, editor, I could go to any major city in America and I would show you images of people lying in the street. And I would show you people falling down in the street if I spend enough time at it. And I could cut this together, and I could present with voiceover a whole narrative about a virus attacking everybody. And with the right angles and the right close-ups and deleting obvious indicators that these were not victims of any virus, but were basically homeless people starving and so forth, I could put together a convincing story about an epidemic. There's no question about that. As far as I know, I mean, I've only seen the one person falling down in the street in China. Maybe there are a few others. This is in a city of, I don't know, 11 million people, and there are other cities. We're talking about 40, 50 million people being locked down in their cities. This is an artifact of media presentation. This is the way it works. You get an image, you tell a story. If you don't like the image, you don't use it because it doesn't fit the story. You know what the story is up front. You know what you're going to tell. So you find the image that seems to support it, and that's the story you tell.
Who's behind it? Who's behind it?
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Pardon?
Who's behind it?
Well, on one level, there are several levels. It's not just a one it. I mean, you've got media, for example. They're always looking for a sensational story for ratings and for advertiser revenue, and reporters are being pushed by editors who say, okay, it's a go on this coronavirus story. We're all in on it. Everybody, let's go. Just like the researchers are told, this is what's happening. You're going to find a sequence of a coronavirus. If you don't, and you think you're going to publish it, you think you're going to say that the World Health Organization characterization of this virus is completely wrong, and you found something else which isn't even a virus or isn't a coronavirus, your career is over. In the same way, a reporter who doesn't go all in on this is completely moved to the margins and is now going to be covering Sunday picnics. So on that level, it's all about a media operation. But the higher you go, eventually you're going to get to pharmaceutical advertisers. What do they want? Profits. How are they going to get the profits? Through vaccines. They're rushing to develop new vaccines against the coronavirus that are going to be billions of dollars. They're going to be extremely dangerous vaccines, and I can describe a couple of these technologies that have never been sprung on the public before. So higher you go on the ladder, the motives change, but it's a ladder and it goes higher into more positions of power.
What evidence do we have that, by the way, Dave Raznick in my interview yesterday, he cited the exact numbers of how many Chinese die from pneumonia every year. And it was, these were staggering numbers, having trouble finding them, but many, many millions. And so when I asked David Crowe, well, what's the difference between, you know, what is corona? What are the symptoms? And it's the same as when I crossed Africa in the early 90s, and I said, what do you mean when you say AIDS? And they showed, we were a small team, they showed us TB, they showed us malaria, and we said, well, why are you telling us that's AIDS? And they said, oh, we call everything AIDS here. So according to David Crowe's paper, the symptoms of corona are consistent with flu. It's cough, fever, flu slash
that turns into pneumonia.
Turning into pneumonia. Yeah. So long, there's nothing novel here. There's nothing new. You know, you don't grow a second head. You don't, there's nothing bizarre here. So they're actually trying to make us think it's a, what's strange about this one is they're ramping it up along the lines. Well, this isn't strange. It actually makes perfect sense. There's been predictive programming. Do you remember the Steven Soderbergh film that came out? I actually remember the year. I believe it was 2010. And I think it was called something like Contagion. Did you see that, John?
I didn't see it, no.
Did you see it, Christina? So it featured, it was a famous actress, not Gwyneth Paltrow, but somebody like that, and she's going up an escalator. She's on her way home from work, and she keels over just like this. So this is this, and this movie, it was horrible. I hated this movie, naturally, but I later found out that it was funded not by Hollywood, but by this. There's a part of the matrix where the military industrial complex slash health organizations, CDC and all of them, fund and even write scripts for Hollywood movies. I'm sure you're familiar with this, John. And for TV shows, they write law episodes of Law and Order. So there's a lot of predictive programming and implanting people with these ideas through our narrative fiction channels so that we're already primed to believe them. So Soderbergh's film was not funded by Hollywood. It was funded by, I don't want to say exactly the CDC, but it's these subgroups that are part of the medical industrial complex, and they're funding movies. Like just that right there alone, I think would shock people if they knew it.
Yeah, especially if they knew chapter and verse. Here's this one, here's that one, here's the other one. Here's another interesting little factoid. The World Health Organization claims, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but this is fairly close, that every year in the world there are between 3 and 5 million cases of ordinary flu, from which, let's say, somewhere between 290,000 and 650,000 people die. That's just ordinary run-of-the-mill flu or flu-like or whatever you want to call it. Do they call this an epidemic? Happens every year, they say. Absolutely not. But let's take the case of SARS 2003, which was, again, basically flu symptoms. They call that a terrible epidemic worldwide. They still do. That's how they write or rewrite the history. And yet, in the same breath, they will tell you, officially from this global pandemic, 800 people died, and that they call an epidemic.
So
the whole thing is completely absurd, insane, upside down.
Well, it's manufactured, which is the worst part about it, I think.
Exactly.
And, yeah, and so I'm still trying to get to the ground zero of how this is, conceived and so on.
Right.
I mean, I think
zero.
I think the press is reactive. I mean, I don't think the press comes up with this stuff. I think
no, they don't come up with it, but certainly
they carry the
press releases. Though.
They carry the official narrative. They carry the official narrative.
Another level here, which is not the highest level, but the CDC will have a marketing seminar or a summit.
That's right.
In which they will say, and Peter Doshi has written about this in the British Medical Journal, marketing vaccines. Okay, so for the flu vaccine, we need to have PR and publicity and propaganda. This is right from their own mouths as they're talking about this. That gives you the public, the most severe possible picture of the dangers of the flu. This is what we have to market. in order to do what? In order to sell the vaccine.
Right.
In order to make people take the vaccine. So we have to paint that picture. This is what they're talking about. Now, get this. The CDC at one and the same moment is buying billions of dollars of vaccines, which they then distribute. So they're a marketing and sales company, and they are responsible for conducting neutral scientific studies on the safety and efficacy of vaccines.
Oh, my God.
And they're having summits about marketing vaccines through spreading the most fear-mongering publicity possible.
That's right.
All right, so that's another level of this where the game starts and where the CDC will interface with the press and tell them what the next big story is and give them press releases and little interviews and puts them along and nudge them into making these stories major stories. This is how it happens. This is how it works.
What are we going to do about the vaccines that they're coming up with? I mean, aren't they going to try and impose those on everybody?
You bet.
And
of course they
what's
will.
In those vaccines? I mean,
okay,
are they safe?
Okay, so here we go. There are several that are, at least three, that are under rush development. And by rush development, I mean Tony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health gave his blessing to a 90-day window to develop a new vaccine against the coronavirus.
Yeah, that's all this is about.
So that's where the rush comes in. Now, let me just briefly describe two of these technologies. One is called DNA vaccines. These have never been licensed openly for use on the public. I'm going to pin this at March 15th, 2015, New York Times article on the new technology DNA vaccines. So they take, quote, a synthesized gene, we won't get into how they come upon this, and they insert that into the body. That's the vaccine. It's not really a vaccine. It's, quote, genetic therapy. And this supposedly makes people immune to a given disease. The only fallout is, get this, it permanently alters the genetic makeup of the person into whom the vaccine is injected.
Oh, my God.
This is in the New York Times. Then they ask Nobel laureate Dr. David Baltimore what he thinks about all this, and he says, yes, this is very interesting. He said, of course, some people might be leery about accepting a vaccine that changes their genetic makeup, do you think? Right? Now, this would mean that every person on the planet who receives this vaccine, part of a giant guinea pig experiment globally, would have their genetic makeup altered in unpredictable ways permanently. Not a visit, not residency, permanent. The other technology called RNA vaccines, again, experimental, never before openly licensed for public use. Another one of these technologies which is being pushed to the front in the rush to develop a coronavirus vaccine. One of the obvious and admitted adverse effects or challenges would be autoimmunity. In other words, the immune system reacting to this type of vaccine would spin out of control and begin to attack the body itself, believing that some aspect of the body is an enemy, an opponent, a germ, a virus, an antigen, whatever you want to call it. And, of course, this is also in the territory of we don't know what the effects of this would be. But if we rush this into production now, we might be able to introduce it in 90 days. So these two are gigantic, untested, unproven, dangerous, highly dangerous technologies that could form the basis for a coronavirus vaccine. And this would be the hammer that would be brought down upon the global population as the solution to the fear of the epidemic. And it is the bottom line. It's the 1-2 punch. Step one, induce fear. Step two, give them the vaccine.
I want to bring out a story that I did. It actually got killed. It was in the year 2000 when there was a magazine around called Talk, edited by Tina Brown. And they called me in and they said, Tina would like a story on gene therapy. And I said, well, I'm unlikely to come back with a story positive about gene therapy if that's what she wants. And they said, oh, just go do it. So I went out and ran right into something absolutely horrifying. It was at Penn State, and that was where the gene therapy research was concentrated at the time. And I went to the PR department. I'll never forget this. And the guy there said flat out, he said, "We killed an 18-year-old kid." And I said, "What?" The kid's name was Jesse Gelsinger, and he was he had a genetic genetic illness, or what do you call it, a genetic aberration that caused him to be unable to eat, to consume hot dogs, i.e. nitrites, I guess. And he loved science, and he wanted to help science and be part of science. So he signed up for this experimental trial in what was then called gene therapy. I don't know if they've changed the name for it. So he was injected with some genetic materials. He and I don't remember how many they were. It wasn't a large number. There were at least two more who almost died, and Jesse did die. And it was a horrific death. His blood turned to jello, and all his organs shut down. And the father was given a huge settlement. The father wanted to go out and warn everybody about the dangers of gene therapy, but he was gagged. I don't blame him. He was grieving. He took the money and he was gagged. And what did happen, though, was gene therapy as a field was temporarily shut down in its tracks, because at least back then they had enough of a sense of shame and horror to just shut it down for the time being, because they had such a catastrophe with that. Yeah, so anytime I hear genetic material, and you know, there's genetic material in all vaccines now, I think. Am I right? You know, from the aborted fetal tissue.
I mean, even genetically modified food is, you know, studies are coming out now showing that genetically modified food, especially like corn and stuff like that, are having negative health impacts. On people, leaky
right.
gut. People cannot process this unnatural food. You know, their guts cannot process this unnatural food. So now we're talking about vaccines
injecting it. Far worse.
That alter the gene. I mean, this is some kind of a nightmare here. And what's going to happen to those of us who don't want to be part of this vaccine?
Let me just so sorry to interject, but before I lose it, can I tell you all the numbers for pneumonia in China? I found it in my transcript with David Rasnick. So there are 1.4 billion people in China. 2.8 million to 17 million Chinese die of pneumonia every year. So why is that not the pandemic we're talking? Why is this a global pandemic? Christina was asking for the Big Bang, where it originated, and you know, I don't think they need one anymore. Christina, you're being very
I'm not talking about ground zero for the epidemic. I'm talking about ground zero, the minds, the people, the individuals who say, "Oh, okay, we're going to do we're going to do this coronavirus campaign now because we want to."
In other words, what's the event where something happens in China where the event with AIDS was, there were these men in San Francisco, New York, LA who turned up, and they really did turn up at hospitals with this mysterious gay cancer, as it was first called. So what is it, I wonder, in a country where up to 17 million people die of pneumonia every year that is causing millions of people to be locked down in quarantine when they're presenting with symptoms that so far I can't tell how they're different from pneumonia or bronchitis or flu?
Right. Well, just consider that the Chinese people were protesting.
Right.
You know, this is not just a simple thing in China. you get thousands of people on the street, and the Chinese immediately begin thinking Tiananmen Square. We're not going to have this. This is not going to happen. These people know that the air is foul and dangerous and causing problems. I quoted an excerpt from an article, I can't remember, it was Bloomberg News, I don't have it in front of me, but it was last summer, I believe. And it was an article about air pollution in Wuhan before this whole thing hit. And a woman said, basically, this sounded like a middle-class woman. She said, I moved out of my apartment. She said, people don't want to move in. She said, but I didn't care. I just had to get out because my son had recurrent, repeated lung problems, and he had repeated surgeries for the lung problems.
Wow.
And I wasn't going to stay where I was. Well, if you start multiplying this kind of thing and people having extreme difficulties breathing and so on and so forth in these cities, they're going to start protesting because their survival is at stake, and the Chinese government is going to look at this and say, no, 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 no. We can't have this. These cities are centers of modern industry and production. It's part and parcel of the new China economy and the thriving global economy that we are the major player in. We're not going to let this happen. Well, I can just simply give you an inference here. I don't have a smoking gun, but it's pretty easy to jump from there to a meeting in which somebody says, we need a cover story, Mr. President. We need another story, another narrative. We need to shut this down. We need to shut these people down at the same time that we shut the story of the incredible pollution down. What are we going to do?
Well, contagion panic is control. And I've been saying this for a very long time, and so have you, and it felt like people didn't get it. People believed contagion, that's bad, I gotta watch out for contagion. It's the ultimate weapon of social, political, and economic control. And therefore, we should all dive in and be extremely skeptical when they say something is spreading and spreading rapidly. There are very few, if any, terrible viruses that kill swiftly in nature. And I'm not even sure that there are any really effective so-called bio weapons. But that's another conversation.
I mean, I'm worried about people being forced to be vaccinated. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, because you can see the announcements coming, right?
Yeah.
In China, there'll be no doubt about it, of course. But outside of China, you could see partial mandates. I've written about this. You know, the president is told of this country or other countries, look, Mr. President, advisors, we don't want to shut down the whole deal here. You know, I mean, this would be bad for you. This would be bad for the election, et cetera, et cetera. But what we can do is we can mandate quarantines on a limited basis in certain areas where we've identified key cases and contagion, et cetera, et cetera. And we can say, in some form or another, that people are going to take the vaccine in that area when we make it available, and that this is part of the deal. We can do that, and we can look at the results. Let's see what happens. Let's see the level of protest and resistance. Let's check this out. This is the way ops are done. Let's have an after report. How much resistance did we encounter? What were the effects? How did we control the situation? Let's do it quickly, swiftly, and get a report on the table. Okay, that worked pretty well. Let's expand this now, if we want to. You know, so some form of this could be in the works. I'm not saying it will be, but it could be in countries outside of China. These kinds of partial mandates and quarantines and orders to be vaccinated, you bet.
Here in the United States, too, I'm really worried about the military, the young men and women in the military, because if they're constantly being forced to take vaccines.
Which is destroying them.
Yeah. You can't, every year, flu, this,
and they
that.
Have,
they, I don't know. My son is in the military.
Yeah.
My son is in the military. I don't know how many vaccinations he's had to have.
But see, that doesn't make any sense, because if nothing else, you'd think a government would want its military men and women to be in tip-top shape physically and mentally. That makes no sense. This whole thing makes no sense. It makes sense financially, and it makes sense at some levels geopolitically, but I don't understand why they're going for vaccinating everybody, which is going to cause catastrophic health effects and
well,
cause health costs.
Well, we don't know they're doing that. We don't know
up.
That yet, that they're doing that. But, you know, I know that I was reading some article today where they're saying, oh, this woman, you know, she hasn't slept for 2 weeks because, you know, she's so busy working on the vaccine.
Right.
I was like, oh, dear God, you know.
The heroes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm getting the sign that we're running out of time, and I'm sad because there was so much else I wanted to talk to you about, big picture stuff, John, but is there any chance you'll come back and talk to us again?
Absolutely, sure. I'd love to. This has been great.
Oh, it was,
we've enjoyed it.
Yeah, we've really enjoyed
it. Well, we've
it.
Enjoyed talking to you. The subject is, I mean, leaving me in a state of terror, I've got to tell you. I mean,
terror is bad. Fear is bad. Let's avoid it at all costs. Let's live.
Man.
Laugh, enjoy our lives.
And not take any coronavirus vaccines.
Exactly.
All right.
John Rapoport, nomorefakenews.com. John, I have to ask you, is it Rapoport or Rapoport?
With a T, pronounce it, yeah.
Rapoport, nomorefakenews.com.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.